Today on the show we have a YouTuber who goes by the name of Maestro Draven, and he takes Sega Genesis video game music and he expands and enhances them. I'll just let you hear an example of it now and we'll go into the interview. Hey, Maestro Draven, good to have you on the show today. How are you doing?
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for making my coding experience more interesting with your amazing background music, making me feel like I'm in my youth again.
That's what it's all about. I mean, music is really good to work with as long as it doesn't have any lyrics in it, because sometimes it can mess with your brain pattern a little bit, at least for me. So,
So what made you decide to start investing a whole bunch of time remaking a lot of the classic Mega Drive games videos, for example, Streets of Rage?
For me, it was it dates back to my childhood when I was playing these games. So every time I would play a Streets of Rage game, I would think to myself, what would the composers have done if they had more time, if they had better technology, if they weren't constrained by an 8 megabyte memory cartridge? What would they have done? So over the years, I thought to myself in my head, like, what would it sound like? And when the technology finally arrived where you're able to do this stuff on your own and you could recreate songs from scratch inside of a DAW, I thought, well, let's do this. Let's see what I can come up with. So the whole idea was first to expand on it and say, well, if they had a little bit more time, how would they, you know, what would the bridge section sound like? What would a new section sound like? Mm-hmm. And from there, it became, well, I got to write the song first. So it was going back into the song, breaking up all the layers and say, well, how do I recreate this thing right from the ground up? And so it's kind of a two-part process. But it really did go back to nostalgia, and it's just my love of the soundtracks in general, and not just for Streets of Rage, but for other games as well.
Yeah, the one I listened to quite a lot was Streets of Rage. I mean, I haven't played Streets of Rage since probably 20 years ago. But the music, it's something about that music that captures my imagination. What do you think it is about that music that does that?
I personally think it's what Yuzo Koshiro did with such limited hardware. Because the Sega Genesis only really has two sound chips. It has the YM2612, and it has, I think it's a Texas Instruments chip. It's a PSG chip. And you can't really do a lot within those confines, yet somehow he managed to create all these instrument presets. He managed to basically recreate Detroit style house and UK style, you know, Eurodance, electronica. He managed to do that all within the confines of a Sega Genesis sound chip. So my first thought was, well, how the hell did they do that? That's quite a tall order. And I think that's why it resonates. I think that the level of creativity that Yuzo Koshiro had, and Motohiro Kawashima too, who was the other composer within the series, I think that they did a lot with very little. And I think that that's why people resonate so well with it, because he was very heavily interested in all those different musical genres that were coming out in the 1980s. Just a mix of different things, acid house, Detroit house, rave, and he sort of jumbled them all together. That's for people who grew up with that music in that particular decade, that is hard to resist. It really is.
I think as a composer, you basically have to make every single note count has to have a reason. Like somebody who's limited with their art or their advertising materials, everything has to be thought out. So there isn't anything there that's just fluff, you know, like,
right,
like, I don't know, filling noise.
Yeah, with when you start to break down these songs, you really start to appreciate what Koshiro did. If you're just listening to it on your headphones or in the car, it sounds a lot more simplistic than it is. When you actually break it down, mm-hmm. and then you start trying to reproduce what he did, you have a much larger appreciation for just how talented he was. Because there are some things in there that really take a lot of elbow grease in order to achieve those particular sounds, and somehow he managed it. So creativity to the max. That guy's got it in spades.
When I first found your channel on YouTube, which anyone can find by typing in Maestro Draven, that is M-A-E-S-T-R-O-D-R-A-V-E-N on YouTube, I thought you just looked at the original Sega Genesis music and then figured it out how to, you know, you basically managed to isolate the sound and then work out the notes. But you've done something a lot more professional and realistic and accurate. Can you just sort of simplify that process down? Because I know you've made a mastery series on YouTube before. It's even over my head, but...
Yeah, it's what I could have done the songs one of two ways. I could have dumped the original files out of the VGM tracks, which are dumped right from the Genesis, and then just did what a lot of remixers do. You know, take a sound bite that's in audio format, put it here, build something else around it. But I felt I'd be doing myself a disservice if I did that, because I wouldn't be putting in the time to actually reproduce the songs. What I wanted to do was break up all the tracks, listen to every note, listen to every preset, and then build the song from scratch in MIDI from the ground up, every single note. That is a tall order. For some songs, it's very easy. I can do it within a day or two. For other songs, it can take me a week before I can actually move on to expanding it. For me, it was composing it in MIDI, finding the instrument presets, bending the notes, making sure that they sounded exactly like they did. There's a lot of pitch shifting that goes into it a lot of the time. I think a big mistake that people think when they think of recreating Genesis music or VGM music in general is just find the instrument preset, type a couple of notes, you're done. It's a lot more involved than that. And that's part of the challenge and the fun, because the more that I do these things, the more that I can recreate these notes, the more I learn, the better I get. And that's part of the reason why I did the Master Tutorial series on my channel, was to show people like, this is not impossible. You know, it might seem daunting, but if you put the time in and you really dedicate yourself to it, you can do it too.
When I was watching your videos on the masterclass and how you did it, I'm looking at someone that has very, very niche not experience in this kind of stuff. So you're not just the average musician that's making music. This is something different. This is like some kind of technical expertise. Where did you get get that knowledge from? And how did you just approach this challenge?
Yeah. I'm terrible with being taught anything. I suck at it. I was never good at that. I was always good at figuring things out myself, self-training myself. Thankfully, with YouTube, you can learn anything. Like literally anything that there is to learn, you can learn it within a couple of lessons. So what I would do is I would start out, hit a roadblock, go onto YouTube or Google and say, well, how do I get past this roadblock? Move a little bit more forward, hit another roadblock. Okay, let's pause, stop, figure out how to do this. Over time, you just develop natural techniques. And so everything that I did has been self-taught, whether it was music, whether it was learning After Effects, whether it was learning graphic design, all through my life. There are some things that you can go to college for, and there are things that you can go to college for and learn on your own. Learning music was one of those things that I thought I could teach myself. And it took a little time, but if you have a basic understanding of it, you can do it. And here's the kicker. It's not the technique side that you really need to focus on. It's what's in here. It's what's in here. If you have it in the heart, the technical side will take care of itself. You will learn how to do it, but you have to have that sensibility in your head. You have to have that music in your head, and you have to want to get it out onto an MP3 or a FLAC file. You have to want to do that.
The source files for these musics, how did you or the person that gave you them extract them from the Mega Drive cartridges?
You can find VGM files online quite readily. I believe people use software to just dump them into .vgm format, which is just another, it's kind of like an MP3, only not. It's just a digital file. VGMs are very different though, because depending on what software you play them on, they'll just loop forever. It's not like an MP3 that has a start and a stop. So what you can do with the VGMs, you can export them out kind of like stems. And I go through this in the Master Tutorial series too, where I actually take a VGM song, I run it through a special program called Multidumper. And what Multidumper does is it breaks all the instrument layers apart. There's, I think, six YM2612 chip layers, and there's four or five PSG layers. So it's essentially like getting remix stems that a normal producer would use to remix a song. And then I just dump them into the program. And now I have separated layers and I can hear now what I'm listening to. It's not just a whole jumble. And from there, I can start dissecting the song and piecing it back together.
So is this VGM a compressed WAV file, or is it something like 8 channels with different MIDI patterns in there or something like that?
Yeah, from my understanding of it, I'm not a technical expert on VGM files, but I believe it's more data-driven than it is audio-driven. I don't think it's pre-recorded audio as much as it is data within the file. And if you play it back in a correct player, like Rimcast, R-Y-M-C-A-S-T, if you play it back in a program like that, again, you'll notice that it just loops on forever and forever and forever. When you dump it, it's a little bit different, though. It does have an ending. It will eventually fade out. So it's kind of a mixture of audio and data. I wish I knew the technical side of the files, but I don't think it's quite exactly like an MP3 or a compressed file, no.
So this file, is this the file that was stored inside of the Megadeth cartridge, or was that?
It's kind of a dump. So what they do is it's like dumping background sprites or graphics from the game. It's or dumping the entire game, which is illegal in a lot of places. This I think is less of an issue. I don't think it's particularly, I don't think it's a red zone area, but dumping the tunes is a little bit different. It's just, you're just dumping one facet of the game files. And again, I don't think it's quite like audio, because it couldn't be. You're ripping it directly from the Genesis, right? And the Genesis didn't have anything like MP3 capabilities or audio capabilities. It's just straight up MIDI data. Mm-hmm.
So when it comes to replicating the sounds, so these chips that are in the Mega Drive, are they using something that's basically a synthesis of, sine waves and triangular waves and squares? And is that quite easy to replicate?
It's pretty much like that. Yeah. If you look at a Sega Genesis virtual instrument, the one that I use is ChipSynth MD. There's quite a few of them out there, though, but ChipSynth's the one that I like. You can really see how they started to make these sounds. There's a lot of oscillators. There's a lot of sine waves. There's a lot of those. A lot of things you typically find in a synth are in there. It's essentially one instrument. So it's just how you tweak those knobs, how you tweak those values, and then you come up with anything from percussion sounds to hi-hats to electric guitar sounds, things that emulate an electric guitar sound. So it's a lot like a synth, I have to say. Yeah.
So I'm just learning about synths, and I'm playing around with Vital and Logic. Vital's I don't even know the correct names for it, because I'm not like a music pro, but it's some kind of wavetable based synth. So is the Mega Drive, is that two different sine waves, or what do you call it, two different channels, or was just the one signal goes into the
I believe
oscillators?
There's multiple. I think there's multiple. I wish I knew the breakdown of the sound chip a little bit more, but I do know that there's multiple oscillators. There's multiple banks that you can use. There's even a sequencer built in. So there's a lot of stuff in there. It's not quite like the one you use, but it's very, very similar in terms of overall approach.
Yeah. So say you've got a song from Mega Drive and you've dumped the files and you've had them split out and you have your Mega Drive virtual instrument. How do you make the sound the same as that channel on the Mega Drive game?
Yeah, that's the main question that I get a lot from people is how did you recreate the sounds? The sounds come in virtual instrument presets. So I use another program, which is called VGM2PRE. And what it does is it will allow you to dump the instrument presets into separate files called TFI files, the ones that I use. You just drag those TFI files and you drop them onto your VST interface, the Sega Genesis VST interface that you're using. And then you listen, is that the bass guitar? Is that the drum hit? Is that the synth? Is that the low end? Like what instrument am I listening to? And then once you find the right one, you just kind of label it. Okay, this is the bass. Then you know what you're working with. A lot of the time, it's not quite that simple. A lot of the times what Yuzo Koshiro would do is he'd get tricky on you. He would take multiple variations of one instrument, like a bass or a bass guitar, let's say. And he would have 5 different variants of it. And every single note would have one of those 5 variants in there. So what do you do now? Now you have to make 5 layers with 5 of the same bass guitar, slightly different. So it used to get kind of tricky. That's where things do get tricky with his tunes. Not a lot of Sega Genesis tunes do that, but if you really want to get creative and you want to create that lush textured sound, you start fiddling with a knob or two and then making multi-layered versions of each instrument.
From a discussion I had with Howard Drossen, who created some of the Sonic Knuckles music, Sonic Spinball music, that one where they have Comic Zone or something like that, I believe.
Yeah.
It seemed to me that it was only something like 8 channels or something for the music. I'm not sure what it was.
In my experience, when I dump music, I usually get 6 YM2612 channels, which is that gives it that Genesis sound. That's the chip that gives it that signature sound. One of those tracks is always blank. So I usually end up with 5 tracks in total, and then I end up with 3 PSG tracks. So 8. Yeah, you're basically looking at 8 in total. That's what I usually end up with. Sometimes 9. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they use an extra PSG track.
I wonder if Yuzo Koshiro will get in touch. Has he got in touch yet?
No. If he ever did, I'd be flabbergasted. He's one of my main... I have a lot of musical influences that are not just in video games, but across the entire spectrum of music. He's definitely up there. He's definitely in the top 10.
I don't think he speaks English, though. That would be kind of a... You need to have a translator to communicate.
Yeah. Yeah, I might have to have a translator. But, he speaks the language of music, so we'll find a way.
So where do you want to take this YouTube channel next?
The channel's basically focusing on Streets of Rage right now, just because it's such an iconic series. From there, I just want to start moving on to different franchises. I might not do entire soundtracks in the future. I might just focus on specific songs, like one song from this game, one song from that game. But Streets of Rage was really a passion project. I started off with the first one in order to get to the second one. Never thought I'd do the third one. And then people kind of convinced me, are you going to do Streets of Rage 3? Are you going to do Streets of Rage 3? Yeah. And I said, all right. It's not my favorite soundtrack. However, when I started doing Streets of Rage 3, it became my favorite soundtrack, which is very, very weird. So once I get those out of the way, I want to start moving on to other things. The channel's also going to grow to incorporate live plays. I might do a Friday Night Live play of a classic game. I might do a review occasionally, and maybe some more lessons too. We'll see how that goes. It all depends what kind of feedback I'm getting from my audience.
Yeah, Saw 3 for Streets of Rage 3 has some... It's good for some really angry workout music, like that first stage. I think it's called Fuse.
Fuse.
Yeah, it's really heavy. I mean, when I first played the game, it was just this completely different vibe from Streets of Rage 1.
It was. Yeah. And, it's almost jarring because what I remember the first time that I played Streets of Rage 3, and I hit the start button, and I get to the character select screen, and I hear Spinning Machine for the first time, and I'm just what am I listening to? I have no idea where this is coming from, because it was so different from Streets of Rage 2, which is very, very Detroit style house mixed with, Prodigy style big beat. And then it goes straight into whatever that is. I do know that the soundtrack was done using a technique that was automated, I believe, in a couple of tracks where it was impossible for a human being to create those notes. That's what gives it that sound. A lot of people don't realize that about the soundtrack, but it wasn't fully composed. A lot of it was automated.
What do you mean a human being couldn't compose it?
Yeah, they used a technique. I can't remember where I read it, but they used a technique of sorts where the notes were pre-programmed in by the computer using some sort of an algorithm, but it would have been impossible for a human being to come up with those notes on his own or her own. And I thought to myself, well, that's an interesting way of doing it. There are some tracks you can hear are clearly composed. They have that classic human element to them. Then there's others that just sound like something like Skynet would make if he ever got into music after Judgment Day. And I think that's what really makes that soundtrack stand out.
Yeah, that's Spinning Fuse level. It's got such a weird intro. It's like a... It's like an electronic scream. You don't have any time to just get into the game. You're just thrown in. But it's not the type of music that I really listen to when I'm programming. It's more Streets of Rage 1, where you have like the first level and probably pretty much Moon Beach in an elevator and Beatnik on a ship, the fifth level.
Which
is just... but then you've done a really good job of... Because those tracks, you can't really listen to them too long because they loop after each other pretty quickly.
Yeah.
And so you're basically composing on top of them, which is a unique way to do it.
Right. That was the reason why I got into it in the first place, because I wanted to hear what a Streets of Rage song would sound like after 1 minute and 41 seconds. That's about how long those tracks went for. Sometimes some of them even less. So I thought, well, this is, you know, like, I get it. They're working under a cartridge, the limitations of a cartridge. They don't have a lot of memory to spare. You know, what would happen if they just went forward a little bit and made, you know, what would a full song sound like? I think the impetus for doing these tracks was listening to Euro-style dance club versions, like 12-inch remixes from the UK, where it was like a 7 or 10-minute version of a song that you only heard in 3-minute and 50-second version before. You know, and there's a lot more to those songs, you know, when you listen to those big 12-inch mixes. And I thought, well, that was kind of the approach that I had towards the Streets of Rage songs. I wanted to make some of them 3 minutes and 30 seconds, some of them 5 minutes. It all depends where the song would take you naturally.
Do you not find that when you finish the first version of the song and you want to add your bit to it, it's quite intimidating because you're, in a sense, competing with Yuzuki Shiro's vision and trying to make something live up to it? So, for example, some of the songs, I think I've done a good job of them. Some of them, I know the bits coming on. I don't like it. It doesn't make sound very good, that bit, but most of them you've done a really good job of it. But you must have some imagination to even just try to do that.
It is daunting depending on the song. There are some songs that I'll walk into where I've had the idea in my head since I was a kid. And Go Straight from Streets of Rage 2. Had it in my head from the beginning. The one I'm working on right now, Moon from Streets of Rage 3, not so much. I'm having a little bit of trouble with that one. Where am I going?
Yeah, so the Unusual
one?
Song. No. Is that the one? I can't remember what stage that is. It's like is it a sunset and you're in the skyscraper with the bosses and businessmen type suits?
It's the one right after Beat Ambience, and Beat Ambience
That's the one on the ground with the train tracks, I think.
That's the one where they're in the dojo, and there's the statues in the background, and you're walking through that dojo.
Right.
But yeah, that one's really, really hard. I'm having a lot of trouble. Like, the song is done. I have the full original song done. Now I'm kind of like, well, where do I step off here? But there are some songs where I thought I'd have a lot of problems with, and I didn't have any problems with it at all. One of the ones I'm most proud of was from Streets of Rage 1. It was Keep the Groovin'. And the way that song went from Koshiro to me feels totally natural if you listen to it, at least in my opinion. This is all subjective stuff. Like, not everyone's going to like my music. Thankfully, most people do. I'm thankful for that. You know, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who are like, why would you do that? That sounds horrible. Yeah. What are you going to do? But, you know, as an artist, you have to do what you like. If you start making art for your audience, you're doing your art wrong. It's like, it doesn't matter what type of art it is. You have to do art selfishly. And if your art is good, people will follow it. And if not, they're not going to follow it. But at least you will be happy with what you've done.
Have you done the one with the Three Samurai?
Yes. Shinobi Reverse. Did that one. I did that one a couple weeks ago, and it's gone over like crazy. Like, people are just losing their minds over it. I got so many. I think it's one of my fastest viewed tracks of all time. There's something about that song that people love.
Can I put it in this video? Just a small part of it?
Like, you bet, totally. Yeah.
Okay, so here we go now. Woo! Okay. Yeah. Was that good, friends?
Yeah, it was. That one was a real favorite of mine because I got to, once in a while with one of these songs, I get to incorporate an instrument that's not from the Genesis. I get to bring in, let's say, Massive, which is a really popular synth and wonderful when you're doing Sega Genesis tunes. In this case, I was able to use a old Japanese flute VST. So that was a lot of fun. I was able to give it a sense of authenticity that I couldn't quite recreate with the Genesis sound chip. At least it would have taken me a very long time to try and figure out what a Japanese flute sounds like in 16-bit. So I thought, well, let's bring in this Japanese flute. It sounds like it fits. I think it sounds pretty seamless, but it really gives it that sense of Japanese authenticity when you're playing that song. So that's where the fun comes in when you're extending these remixes.
It's really... Are your songs appealing mostly to middle-aged men like ourselves?
Oh, yeah.
Or are you finding like a younger generation that's not even played the games and never will play the games listen to it?
Hell no, my friend. Hell no. when I look at my analytics page, it is 33 to 49 right across the board, 99%. And I think I have 99.6% male and the rest is female. So yeah it's a niche market. It's for a niche. This.
Because we're not going to go and listen to like games that are before our time because we just have no reason to do it. But it's sort of it is nostalgia, isn't it, man? It's not gaming passion because we don't have time for playing games, really.
Right.
It's something different than playing games. It's just music. And music is sort of transcendent than... You can be doing other things and listening to music, you know, and it's good memories from being a kid.
Yeah, I want to be the guy that that caters to that niche market. I don't want to be the one size fits all guy. I don't mind if what I do gets less of an audience because I'm catering to something that people have wanted, and they've indicated to me that they wanted this. You know, where has this music been? I'm like, well, you know, this is just my take on it. I would love for other people to get involved in this too. It's part of the reason why I did the tutorial series. I'd love to encourage would-be composers of all ages to say, you know, well, maybe I'll give this music thing a shot. And I've told people, once you're done, send me some links and I'll feature them on the channel. I really want to...
It is technically hard though.
It's hard. I tried to make the tutorial series as accessible to newcomers as possible, but the objective was, okay, here, I can't go back to the days of the Arc here, but what I can do is I can at least say, here's a good launching point. Let me walk you through the basics as I'm teaching you. So it was basically all the techniques that I would need to make this music, you're going to learn. You're not going to learn every technique, but you're going to learn the specific ones that will help you. And if there's something that you get stumped on, go and watch a tutorial. There are tons of tutorials on Ableton or just composing in general that are out there.
I think what's also complicated with Sega Genesis is that some of these chips have upgrades to them. And for example, I don't know if you ever played Subterranea.
Yeah.
So the soundtracks from most songs, like the title screen, is like 5 or 6 minutes long. I don't know why they made it so long. And also Red Zone, the one with the helicopter, both have some really long tracks. And I don't know how they managed to fit that into they must have some upgrades in the chip.
I think it might have been the cartridges themselves. I remember when the Genesis first came out, I was like 9 or 10 or something. And they were operating under very, very small cartridges. And then all of a sudden Strider came out and they were bragging about how it was the first 8 megabyte Genesis card. And I imagine that over time they expanded the memory inside. I'm not quite sure how far they could go with it. But I imagine that over time as the games became, you know, as the timeline progresses, we start moving into 1994. You're going to need to start competing with even the PlayStation at that point. Mm-hmm. So you're going to need to kind of up your game a little bit, in those latter years of the 16-bit age.
It's almost like, compared to the programmers now, it's like the guys at NASA versus the guys, I don't know, with like a home-built kit, like Unreal Engine and everything just runs out of the box. I mean, how did they make this Mega Drive to be able to run all the games for about 9 years, including the upgrades to the Mega Drive was compatible with cartridges with upgrades in the cartridges. I mean, what did they do to make that work, really?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. I know EA made their own cartridges at one point in direct defiance to Sega, and that kind of got them in some hot water at one point. And then they worked out some sort of a deal. But EA was rogue back in the day, man. I don't know what they did to their cartridges, but they must have done something.
Yeah, the one with the big yellow bits at the side.
Yeah, like that was an FU to the whole establishment at that point. I don't know if they did anything special to the cartridges aside from the yellow tab, but those yellow tabs were instantly recognizable. I think a lot of it has to do with the cartridge itself. I think it's less the hardware and the machine, more the cartridge itself, which obviously nowadays is totally different. Now we have a PS 4 Pro after a PS4. You know, we're getting upgrades of existing consoles. Like, the most we ever got was maybe the Sega CD or the 32X back in the day. Mm-hmm. Even the Super Nintendo had a CD at one point, and that got scrapped. So that was a fairly novel idea at the time.
I think the developers for the Sega Genesis, they had the knowledge of the internals of the system. They had assembly language knowledge. But the developers now, it seems like they get like something like Unreal Engine 4 or 3 and mm-hmm. compile the game for the console. I'm not sure. I'm not a game developer on these consoles. But I think also PlayStation 2 was quite difficult to program for. It was quite a lot of niche knowledge. But I mean,
I think the worst one, I think it was the PS3 that was the hard one. I think the PS2 mm-hmm. was easier. The hardest one to program for, to my knowledge, was the Saturn, at least back in that era. And that's one of the reasons why the PlayStation was able to sort of take over, because the developers couldn't figure out the Saturn. They're looking at the internals and we don't know what we're doing here. So the PlayStation kind of cleaned house when it came to that. I think a lot of the reason why the Genesis music stands the test of time is because of that YM2612 chip. I think that's a Yamaha chip across the board. We've heard variants of it in various synths back in the 80s and 90s. So when they decided to stick one in the Genesis, I think that was a smart move, a very smart move, because it's got a sound that's a lot different from anything else. Even the Super Nintendo, which technically had a superior sound chip, did it though? I'm not convinced. I think that the music that you're able to create with the Genesis is far more eclectic and there's far more variety that you can do with it as opposed to the Super NES chip.
Yeah, my chill playlist on YouTube, which I listen to when I'm software developing, it's a mixture of PlayStation games and Mega Drive games. But I don't often have SNES tracks in there. Maybe Star Fox for Tana now and again, it gets a bit repetitive, you know, drumming away with this little drum noise.
One of the things about the Super NES is you're usually always hearing the same instruments, no matter what game it is, whether it's an action game or a shooter or an RPG. You're hearing that Super NES sound, which you're also hearing that Sega Genesis sound too in Sega Genesis games, but there's so much more room to create different sounds than there is with the SNES. So I think that's the differentiating factor between the two. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any plans to do some of the Sonic soundtracks?
Absolutely, yeah. Sonic, I might not do the entire soundtrack, but I will do, you know, one or two. I think Sonic's...
I'm looking forward to that, man. That's going to be fantastic.
It'll be a lot of fun. There's others, too, that I want to do. Revenge of Shinobi is one that I started way back in the day, and then I purged on my back catalog because I wasn't happy where it was going. But I'm going to be finishing that up, too, because a lot of fans are huge Revenge of Shinobi fans.
Yeah, I think the first level is the one that most people like, because that's the only level they could play, because they weren't good enough to get by the boss at the first level, you know? And that game was tough, man. Sheesh.
I remember first playing Revenge of Shinobi when I was a kid, and I got to the second level with the waterfall, and it took me weeks to figure out that triple jump at the end with those three logs that come down the waterfall. Oh, what kind of voodoo is this? Like, yeah. do I have to sacrifice a virgin to win this level?
I only play that game with cheats on, man, like the unlimited ammo. I don't know how you play it without the unlimited ammo with it.
Yeah, there was that code, wasn't there? You hover your input over the shurikens in the options menu, and it turns to an infinity symbol after 10 seconds. And you get,
the game is still hard.
Yeah, it is. It is a hard game. Even now, I fall victim to the same pitfalls that I did when I was a kid. So, but again, it's another Yuzo Koshiro soundtrack. Obviously, it's going to be amazing. He was really in his prime with that first wave of Genesis games. He really was.
But it does have one of the most infamous bosses, that guy at the end with the hair. I mean, I never even got anywhere near close to that boss, but you look at the replays of that people fighting that boss, you're like, it's just stupid how difficult the last boss was, you know?
Yeah, because you have to prevent the wall from crushing your girlfriend.
Yeah.
While at the same time battling this guy that detaches his hair from his head and throws it around
You never figure out how to fight that without watching a replay. And there's a few games that have a sort of post-traumatic stress effect on our lives. We didn't have magazines. We didn't have like Google to figure out how to... There's games that we had as kids that we just never completed because we, we were not clever enough to do it, or we didn't have anyone to help us, you know?
It's so true. I remember when I was a kid, and kids today will never understand this, but when we were kids, you know, when you used to play like an old Sierra game, like King's Quest or Police Quest or Space Quest, and you couldn't figure out where to go, you get stuck for weeks. What would you do? You'd write into the company. You'd send a letter to the company in the mail. You'd have to wait a couple of weeks for the letter to come back telling you how to beat this one. Well, now you just go on the internet and you find it in 2 seconds. It's the world's changed so much. So I think that's one of the reasons why people like to go back to the old days. They like the nostalgia. They like a simpler time, a slower time. So when people hear the Streets of Rage soundtracks or any other of those old games, I think it just, you know,
people are not playing those games though. I mean, I don't think are playing.
And they really should. Like, I have two nieces. I've tried to get them into platform gaming, and depends what the game is. Like if it's Mickey Mouse and Castle of Illusion, they're more susceptible. But if it's, Contra, no. I don't think they're into that.
Contra, Contra for the SNES was better than the one on the Mega Drive. Probably
very much. Very much.
I didn't have the SNES, and I always went into my mate's house. I mean, the thing is, as kids, you remember how excited it was when you're like, you basically go to your friend's house and they would ask their mom if you could come in.
Yes.
And if they came in, it was like,
yes. Because like, he had an NES and he had all the cool games. You know?
There was like a barrier to, you know, like you didn't know you were waiting, was she going to say yes or no? And if you got a yes, you were sorted for the next 3 hours, you know? Yeah. And you got used to the smells of people's houses because it's a sort of weird thing, you know? Even if you go back now, like 20 years later to the old house, if they still have it, you can still smell like, it's got the smell of these like youthful times you're playing.
And it brings
game,
it all back. It brings it all back in your head. Like I had a friend, he lived in my old town. He lived four or five houses up the street from me. So it took me 30 seconds to get there. And he had an NES and I had a Genesis.
Ooh,
we both had a plethora of games for both systems. So do you want to trade for the weekend? So we used to trade each other's consoles, you know, and that was even before the days when they were renting consoles at the 7-Eleven. Which they only got into, you know, early 90s. It's nostalgia is such a powerful thing. But here's the problem with nostalgia. It can also be a trap if you're not careful. This is a mistake that a lot of people make when they try to use nostalgia for modern properties. Like, I'll give you a perfect example. Transformers Bumblebee. Fantastic movie. Loved it. I think it's one of the best Transformers films, if not the most. If not the best. But did it sell me that it was taking place in the 1980s? No. And the reason is because you cannot just play a couple of 1980s heavy metal tracks one after the other and get away with that. That doesn't cut it. It was missing that 80s feel. So people need to be very, very careful when they rely on nostalgia, myself included too, because if I don't get creative enough, I'm being derivative. If I get too creative, I'm stepping too far away from the original vision. So there's a balancing act in there for me.
This is sort of observation that I've had as gaming when I was a kid. The best memories I have are when I was going around to my mate's house playing those games together. Like he's sitting there, I'm sitting there, we're taking turns, you know?
Co-op, yeah.
But when I look back to my past, when I'm sitting playing these games by myself, I don't have good memories of that because that was basically me sitting by myself playing these games for hours and years and years. Yeah. And I was young enough that I didn't have the internet. So maybe it wasn't as social because, like, you know, before when people were sitting home playing games, they were playing them by themselves. So maybe it's a bit improved now, but you're still, even if you're doing social gaming, you're still, I don't know if it's the same as if you're playing with people in the same room as you, you know?
Yeah, online gaming is a bit of a mixed bag, I think. I don't think there's any substitute for having, like when I was 16, 17, my friends and I would rent GoldenEye. I think we spent more money renting GoldenEye than we would have spent had we pooled our money together and bought the damn thing. So every weekend we used to book that game, GoldenEye. And I had an N64, so I got the business of procuring the game every weekend.
Yeah.
And we used to... Oh boy, when you're 16, you can buy 5 bags of chips, 3 bags of 3 bottles of Fanta and Coke, and you can sit there and play the game until the sun's coming up. Those 4-player multiplayer matches, just the stuff of dreams. Yeah. And nowadays that's gone, and now we don't play games like that because now everything's online. You join people in a lobby that you'd never seen before. You talk to them on a microphone. They swear at you. They insult you. It's not the same. It really isn't.
Yeah. I don't know if that's a fair trade, because when I had Halo before anyone else had it, I saved up since a kid, and I bought the Halo, I had it for everyone, I bought the controllers, and me in my room used to have like 7 or 8 guys in this room, actually, the same colored walls, and we'd be sitting here for, you know, playing Halo on the screen, and of course your pixels are much, I don't know how many pixels a TV has, it's 720 or something like that.
At the time, I think we were operating under, it started out at 720p and then went up to 1080i. Yeah. 1080i, and then it went up to 1080p after that. So
we played all the Halo games with 720 and 4x4 screen, and you know, we used to always tell each other, "Don't look at my screen," you know. But you know, people did it anyway. But some people you didn't do it with, which is quite funny, because I remember this guy called Owen, right? And he would be quite emotional, and when we were playing Halo, and he'd be running around on one of the Halo bases on the other side, the first Halo, and I'd be sitting with a sniper rifle, and he'd just like go for some headshot, and he'd physically go next to me, sort of do that, like, "Oh," it was the most funny thing, and he'd start swearing and all that stuff, and so my mom and dad would come in, and I'd like, "See, oh, don't swear," you know.
Yeah, we used to have the swearing matches too in our matches too. It's part of the fun. The 4-player split screen mode was a weird thing. It was kind of because you could see everything.
I still enjoyed it much more than any of the things I've played online with a full HD 4K. It's nothing beats about sitting with the person next to you and I don't think, I think a lot of people have missed that out, and they'll never go back to that because they're being spoiled with this antisocial sitting down and
I'm a short-term pessimist and a long-term optimist. I always have been, and when I look at what's going on right now, I like the generation, they're stuck to their phones, they're in their Xbox lobbies, and they, you know, they never go out, they never talk to anyone. I think that this is a growing pain. I don't think it's going to be permanent. I really don't. I think that like a lot of things, it's going to change. The new generation is going to say, "Well, I don't want to be cooped up in my house all day. I'd like to go out and hang out with someone, or bring someone over and play a game over here." I think that the technology will evolve for that too. I think games are going to get more interactive. They're going to get more away from your TV, away from your PC screen, more into the active, you know, in the moment, right there in your living room style play. And I think that that's going to be good for people. I mean, we've already seen the first version of it with Wii U Sports, you know, like that's kind of that will forever be looked at as the distant relative, the distant predecessor of whatever is going to come next. And I hope it's not that Facebook Meta, because that is not going to be good for anyone.
I don't really understand what it's all about. Why are you worried about that?
Well, I'm worried about it because what's going to happen is you're going to have an entire generation that's stuck in a virtual world where they are trying to be someone that they're not, and they're not. They think that they're going to have that social interaction, and they're not. I think it's going to be just as toxic as a typical forum, a typical YouTube forum. Whoever thinks that this is going to bring humanity closer together, I think that they're wrong. There is no substitute for looking someone in the face, like you and I are doing right now. I mean, we're doing it across a vast distance, but there's no substitute for looking someone in the face, looking in their eyes, having a conversation with them dead square. And whatever Facebook's trying to do with this Meta thing, I have my doubts.
But this just, if you look outside, like, there's hardly any kids playing in the parks nowadays. Like, where I'm staying now, like, the parks were full of people, you know, and you just don't hardly see kids playing out that much. I mean, okay, you have less physical accidents with people running in each other, there'll be less golf balls flying around, hitting people's windows, which is all part of growing up in a council estate, you know?
Yeah.
But I don't think the a lot of kids nowadays look physically healthy. They look very pale.
Yeah.
You go out for a game of football with them, and I'm just looking back from when I was like 22 or something, and we still, you know, still did that with friends. But some of these guys that were gamers, they'd come outside and they'd look completely white, you know.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're sitting with them in the room playing games, and well, I was actually studying a lot of time because I was at university, and they were playing games, and you hear them moaning about the sunshine. "Oh, the effing sun! You know, I hate the sunshine." You know,
but again, I think that that's going to go away. If you look at the millennial generation, when they go to a workplace, they don't want fluorescent lights, Nope, they want natural lighting. They want large open windows with the sun coming in. I think that we're going to get back to a more natural state. And it can't come soon enough. I remember when I was a kid, I was 7 or 8. And my old man, he gave me a box of nails and a hammer and said, go build a treehouse in the bush behind your, but behind the house. And I went, okay. And you'd come back and you'd hit your thumb with the hammer and it'd be purple. And back in the day, you know, that was totally fine. Nowadays, they'll send child services over because you're endangering your child. It's absolutely ridiculous.
I cannot stand the nanny state when they do things like that, you know, like, and it's, just the whole, this kind of control is everywhere we go. And now they're talking about banning crypto and all this stuff. And people are losing lots of money. It's just shocking. You know, it's just, this, the last podcast, people, if you want to find out my thoughts on that, there's a libertarian guy called Jeffrey Tucker. And you should go listen to that one before, then you'll get. But I can go into that rabbit hole pretty quickly.
Me too. I'm not for me, it always goes back to the 1980s and to an extent, the 1990s, at least the first half. Kids who grow up today will never, ever understand just how awesome the 1980s was in every single regard. It was the, in terms of atmosphere and overall feel and mood, it is the polar opposite of what we're experiencing today.
You're a bit older than me, so like I was at 1990. I was 6, so I think you're. But I got a little bit of a vibe of the 80s. But yeah, keep going. This is great.
Yeah, I was born in 78, which was the best time to be born because I grew up in the 80s. I was there when. You know, all these major heavy metal bands were coming out and I was getting exposed to them. My first album that I ever heard was Pyromania by Def Leppard and it blew my mind. I put the headphones on and my parents were rockers. So they got me into this type of music from an early age, you know, but I was there when Tim Burton's Batman was a worldwide phenomenon. I remember going to the theater and seeing it and people were just like, What did walking out of the theater and people are hopping up and down. They're like, it's like they had a sugar rush. Like we don't see this nowadays. And it's really, really sad. It's really, really sad that people don't get excited over things anymore. Like even a Marvel movie comes out. Oh, I can't wait to see the new Marvel movie. And there's an excitement there. Even that, the level of excitement is not what it was when I was a kid or even in the 90s, the mood started to go down a little bit in the 90s. We started to become less dreamy. We weren't dreaming as much. We were becoming more practical at the expense of our hopes and our dreams. And I think that sort of just built up.
But do you think that's a result of those movies like Batman that did that?
In what way? In terms of the mood?
Well, like you'd be talking about people had a sugar rush with the Batman. But you think that Batman contributed to these problems going forward?
Well, no, I think what started the problem was when we started making movies that were not that were trying to be too realistic and too practical. And it's the same thing with video games too. I mean, there's some amazing video games that have come out over the years. But do they recapture that same vibe that you got when you first got your first Sega Genesis or your first NES and you plugged in Super Mario Brothers? My wife came from Poland. She was under communist occupation in Poland and she left in the early 90s. And when she got to America, she played Super Mario Brothers for the first time and she was flabbergasted because there was nothing like that in Poland at the time. Something that you take for granted when you're living over here. But there's games that come out that are really, really good and they're a lot of fun and you have a lot of, you really enjoy them, but are they phenomenons in your life? Not so much nowadays. And if you're an adult, it's different because when you're a kid, it doesn't matter what it is. Anything will blow your mind. Doesn't matter what it is. You go out for, like Lemmy said, Lemmy Kilmister from Motorhead. He said, a day at the beach will blow a 12-year-old's mind. It's true. So when you're our age, it's a little bit different. You don't quite get as excited at things, but even kids today, I don't see any excitement in their eyes when I look in their eyes. When they hear music, I hear, okay, that's a cool track or whatever. Yeah, maybe I'll listen to that. Maybe I'll put it on my playlist. I don't see that same energy, that zest and that zeal and that excitement anymore. Mm. And it's very
interesting because obviously as you become old fuddy-duddies, things are going to become less interesting because it's the way it is. But we have two control groups here. So we have the kids in the 80s and the kids in the 2010s. And we are basically theorizing that they were happier in the 80s. And let's do a thought experiment and try and figure out what that is.
Yeah. I think it was, I think it was the mood. There's way too much negativity in everything these days. I think that we've had our fill of anti-heroes in pop culture. I think it's always good to have an anti-hero from time to time, because it just goes to show, listen, the world isn't perfect, and Superman, not everyone is going to be Superman. But I think that we, somewhere along the line, we had an overload of anti-heroes. We had an overload of nihilism. I remember going to see Lord of the Rings for the first time, Fellowship of the Ring, and I think in 2001, was it? And I drove in a blizzard for 2 hours to the neighboring city where it was playing at the Odeon. And I went in there and I walked out and it was one of those things again, where I walked out and I couldn't believe what I just saw. It was in a daze. I was driving home in the blizzard, trying to make sure that I didn't drive into a snowbank, just because I was so blown away by what I had just seen. Have we experienced anything like that since? We've come close a few times, but how many phenomenons that uplift you, that make you feel wonderful, that really speak to your heart? How many of those are we seeing nowadays? I'm not seeing a lot.
Yeah, one of my favorite ones that kind of did that for me was Tom Cruise's Edge of Tomorrow. Really captured my imagination. Also, Oblivion did that a little bit to me. I don't know what it is about Tom Cruise as an actor that I really, just the way he is, it's fantastic.
Obviously, he's a great actor.
He's a great actor, but, you know, we have a slight difference of opinion when it comes to religion, but, you know.
he's a bit kooky in real life, but, you know, I think he means well. I think he's a guy that means well. And when I go and see a Mission Impossible movie, I'm just like, wow, this is fantastic. Yeah. I like watching Tom Cruise. I think he's a fun guy.
Mission Impossible movies don't really do it for me that much. I think they're clicky. Oblivion was... I've watched that a few times.
Yeah, yeah. Even James Bond. I mean, look what they did with James Bond. I mean, James Bond used to be fun. I didn't really get into Bond until Brosnan and Goldeneye, and that was an era where sort of the young generation was getting back into Bond, and you know, the adults were like, well, okay, it's whatever, it's just another Bond movie. But then it got into the Daniel Craig era, and they're okay. But I mean, the push for realism, that dark tone. You know, him not cracking jokes, him not cracking one-liners. It kind of did something to the franchise. I mean, even Connery had his occasional one-liner, and there was a feeling of adventure to those movies. Whereas the Craig era was kind of just like, okay, it's just another spy movie. I'm not really feeling it.
Yeah, I don't really pay too much attention to Daniel Craig because Bond movies too much. Pierce Brosnan, yeah, Tomorrow Never Dies. That was a good
Tomorrow
one.
Tomorrow Never
Goldeneye,
Dies.
Goldeneye.
And listen, they got nuts and they got silly, and Brosnan dropped out, and that's why we got Craig. But I can give a free pass to a bad property that makes you feel good. I can do that any day of the week.
A bad property,
like a bad franchise, or a bad movie, or a bad album, a cheesy album. You know, I can give a pass to, yeah, I can give a pass to anything that would be critically panned that happens to make me feel good, or happens to make me, you know, feel better.
I think also another problem with the kids today, we really are sounding like old fuddy daddies, you know, like those kids of today, did they know all about the 80s? Give me some Dawn's pills, please.
Yeah. Go to your room.
I think also the problem with today's entertainments is like overdose of sugar, right? So I kind of regret having my own console, because those memories don't compete with memories of having like just having to wait to go to my friends to play the games. They always were better, and you know, I wish I never had a games console, to be honest, the amount of time I wasted on it. But in terms of just like the instant access to movies now, we have, you know, you have all the different streaming services. But you know, people don't seem to read as much, and I think that a good solution for that is audiobooks, because the Dune audible book is about 10 times better than the movie. The movie is terrible compared to the audiobook, and the movie is a good movie, right? But compared to the audiobook, you're taking your mind on a low quality adventure, because people just think, oh, it's words on a page. And it's audio coming through the. How does that compare with the movie? Well, completely different. when you're ingesting in audio or text, your mind is creating the images and pictures, and you experience it in a deeper level than the actual movie itself. So
you do, yeah.
You'll never capture the essence of Dune by going through the movies. The book has it, you know. And the first two books in Dune were brilliant. And that's I want to try and do that myself. I'm working on a little YouTube channel now where I'm drawing things. I'm going to start narrating what I'm drawing and making it into a little sci-fi. And I have some ideas to make it more like give the audience a choice. What should we do next in the audio? I'll just put a link to this channel here, and you can check it out.
Yeah. And you're going back to something again. I'm going to go back to the 80s here. But when I was a kid in school, we used to have these books called Choose Your Own Adventure. I don't know if you've ever heard of them. There's a series called Choose Your Own Adventure, and you would read the books.
Yeah,
you would read the book.
Those are scary, man.
Yeah, and you'd get to a certain page, and you'd have a fork in the road. If you decide to go this way, turn to page 109. If you decide to go the other way, turn to page 220. And you say, "Wow, you know." So you turn to, "Well, I want to go left on this path, you know." So you go to page 109, and something would happen. Then you'd want to reread the book again to see what happens when you took a right instead of a left, you know. So
yeah.
And then we started to see that take the form of video games. I think that was the first one the first games that really did that were, I think, the Sierra games, you know, the King's Quest games and the Space Quest games. Mm. And then from nowadays, it's that sort of RPG, quote unquote, RPG style approach is now, you know, you can choose your own adventure in Skyrim within 5 seconds. You boot up Skyrim and you can do whatever you want, go wherever you want. Do the quest in whatever order you want. So, but I don't think there's any
open world games just don't do it for me at all, man. I just think it's just so boring. Just going around leveling up and getting higher levels, until you're maxed and doing the same missions again and again and again. Like I just don't get it at all.
Yeah. But I see where it all came from, and it did come from those books. Yeah. So what you're suggesting is it brought back the memory of those old days when I was staying after 3:30, because I was a bit of a nerd when I was a kid. Not nowadays, folks. I'm totally different now. I used to stay till 4 o'clock and just read these books, and then you know, it kind of got my mind excited.
Yeah, I played a Sonic the Hedgehog one, and the thing is, you could die in those books, and you have to go through the whole book again. And I was very strict with this one book. Yeah. I think I died 3 times and I had to go to the beginning of the book again. And I remember with a dice sitting there at this bit where in Sonic the Hedgehog, where there was a book that, like, listen, you're on this spaceship, and like, I know, like, if you roll the wrong part, I'm sitting there sweating about to roll. I was so truthful to this book, you know, and then roll this dice, and then you either feel terrible or you're like, yes, this book. But I never thought I'll just give myself a mulligan, as you say.
Well, I mean, it's like they always say, you can have the best looking video game, but the best looking world is the one that you create in your own mind. It's your own imagination. And right now we are in a bit of a lull when it comes to creativity. It's all been done before. People are sort of just rehashing the same thing, sticking to a prepackaged formula and just for the money to roll in. There is an opportunity for creative minds to really strike it rich, whether it's in games or whether it's writing a book. I mean, now is the time. For all those would-be writers out there, now is the time to write a sci-fi novel that you've been thinking of. Now is the time to get that fantasy novel series that you've had in your head. Get it on paper. Get it published, because someone's about to pick it up.
Yeah.
Because there is a demand for that.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm getting bored of being a computer programmer, man. Like I would love to do more creative stuff. Yes.
Yeah.
That's why I'm pushing hard on the whole creative thing. And podcasting's creative as well. I enjoy this.
Yeah, it's a great way to meet people. It's a great way to get to, again, if you want to find all these new authors and writers and political voices, and all, I mean, you have to give them a platform to be heard. And I think we're going to move into that more and more. I think that people have they're kind of exhausted with the status quo.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know where to go next. We've covered so many topics.
I know we kind of went off the deep end. Yeah, I'll go anywhere. I don't mind.
On you go.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, for me, it all goes back to the music. One of the reasons why I do the music is because it was a better time, at least in my mind. And it's certainly better than anything I'm experiencing right now. And hopefully we're going to get back to those days again. So,
yeah. I mean, I don't know what your worldview is, but I believe that nostalgia is not something that's designed to depress you. I'm going to do a podcast on what I think the purpose of nostalgia is. It has a reason and a purpose. Yeah. So,
yeah. Well, nostalgia is history, and history is something that you learn from. And if you refuse to learn from history, don't be surprised when things go bad. For me, nostalgia, when I think of anything nostalgic, I'm thinking back not to bad things. I'm thinking to good things. I'm thinking, how can we make today more like it was when everyone was happy during the time period that I grew up? Mm-hmm. And I don't need to go back. I don't need to be 12 to appreciate that. I can do that at 43. I can do it. Because I know that it was a better time. I know that it wasn't just my mind. If I go onto YouTube right now and I watch a plethora of 80s commercials, like those 30-minute compilation videos, I instantly remember why the 80s was so good, or it could be different for someone else. I watch 90s commercials on YouTube, and that's why I love growing up in the 90s. Everyone has their own memory, but I think there are some decades, like if you look at the 60s, the 60s was in a lot of ways a very stupid time, but it was also a very good time too, because there we did have the one love thing, peace, and all this, and it was, the idea was great. The execution of it was completely ridiculous, but can anyone deny that the 60s was a nice time? I mean, it had its problems.
I think
just
the standard
like
of living was better then.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't understand. That's one thing I don't understand. Like, we have, like in the 50s, you could basically have one guy working at home, one guy working, and his wife can look after the kids. Yeah. Now, two people can barely make ends meet. So I don't understand why you have 50 years, 60 years of technology, and yet people's lives are harder. It doesn't make any sense to me at all.
Yeah, there's two ways to look at that. You can look at it one way, which is people that were living in the 50s were not living as good as even the poor people are living today. There's that. And that's true too, because the poor today are living better than people in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. But at what cost? Like Elizabeth Warren, who's, you know, she's a very controversial politician in the United States. And she wrote a book years ago called The Two-Income Trap, which was all about two parents going to work. What does that do to the kids? What does that do to the family unit? What does that do to society in general? Well, now she's completely flipped and she doesn't pay attention to that, to her own book at all, which is kind of a shame, but she made some really good points there. When I was growing up, my mom was a nurse. My dad worked in the mines. He was a truck driver at the time. But it was still very different. They would get off work. I'd be at my grandma's place. My grandma would watch me during the day when I came home from school. They'd pick me up at 4 or 5, and it was a different thing. Nowadays, it's almost like parents really don't get any time with their kids till around 8 or 9 o'clock, because there's always something on the go. There's always something holding them back. There's always something that's dividing their time. And like anything, I don't think it's left or right. I think it's in the middle. I think there's a solution in the middle point.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, it seems like things are happening so fast nowadays that it's almost a new social experiment for humans. How do they approach this thing? I was talking to Jeffrey the other night there, and he's saying, we haven't seen a situation where we have a democracy like the West unravel, like we potentially could see with the divisions of society. Austria, we all know what's happened in Austria. Scary.
I don't think it's going to get to the point people think it's going to get to. And I think that here's the danger. We've been filled with so much nihilism for so long that we almost expect the worst case scenario. We're less prone to expect people waking up and saying, no, had enough of this. In Australia, I think complacency has led to what they're experiencing right now. Now, is it too late? No, I don't think it's too late. I think that they can turn that around. I think that it's going to come down to the votes. It's going to come down to, you know, who's going to give you your freedom, who's not going to give you. And we can have the argument about the individual topics, but I do think something good is going to come of this. I do think we are going to get back to a 1980s-esque era. I really do feel that way. But in order to get there, people need to not automatically go to the worst case scenario and say, yes, this is going to happen for sure, because not unless you let it. If we as a collective society say, listen, we want a better time, we want a happier time, we don't like all this negativity, we don't like all the fighting, I think we can get back to something that's nicer. And again, I'll go back to my music again. What I do is very, very simple. I don't have a huge audience, but it's my way of making people smile, at least for 5 minutes. And if I can do that, I've done my job.
Yeah, but I'm looking forward to hearing Emerald Hill Zone extended because it's too small, it's too short, you know, and it needs to be longer. And
you brought me on your podcast, you get a request, and I will honor that request, sir. You got it. I'm down.
Metropolis City could be good. That could be a good one. That's quite a good one. But Sonic and Knuckles is the best music, I think, of all of them. Flying Battery Zone. That's going to be hard to do, man, to live up to Flying Battery Zone.
I would love to clone myself just to do all these songs. Some of them take me 2 weeks, some of them take me a week. But if I could accelerate the process anymore and do more songs, I would, because there are so many songs I want to do. Thunder Force 3 is a major one that I want to do after Revenge of Shinobi. But I do think that the channel, as I move forward, is going to become a little bit more of a mixture of different games as opposed to just focusing on one soundtrack at a time.
And then, are you going to try to do anything that's done on a CD, like the PlayStation? Is that worth your time, or is it just too much like real music?
I thought about it. I try to stick to the chiptune era because there's room for creativity there. I think that when we started to get into the 32-bit and 64-bit eras, they've kind of already made their full songs. I mean, there's not a lot of room to expand on what's already there. Like, what am I going to do? Am I going to make a 5-minute song, 7 minutes, 8 minutes? I'm not sure it would go over as well. There are some soundtracks where I might actually retrograde them. This is a concept I've been thinking of, is to take a modern game or a game that came out PlayStation 2, PlayStation 3, and make it into chiptune.
Like the Halo theme and put it into Mega Drive format.
Yes.
This, I think you could have a really strong niche here, and you could have game developers coming to you for like, Meister Draven made this song as one of the credits, you know, kind of deal.
I'm all for it. I mean, I'll work with anyone anytime. I'm the easiest guy on earth to work with. So if any company wants to contract me out, or even an independent, like an indie developer, if they want to get me on board, hey, I'm all for it. Absolutely.
Also interesting what we've seen with games is a lot of them are trying to recreate that sort of retro feel, aren't they, with some of those Steam games. Yeah. I've never actually played half of them. I don't have time, but I watched a replay at like 3x speed just to see how they do the boss fight or something like that. But
yeah, there's one you would really like. It's called Black Future 88. You basically have an explosive charge in your head, I believe, and you have a limited amount of time to get as far through the game as you can before the explosive goes off in your head. But it's got nothing but 1980s synthwave and retrowave, and it's done this really tech noir style. You know, kind of like Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon, that same type of feel. It's a fun game. It's just, there's no end to it, I don't think. I don't think you can actually beat the game. I just think you can beat your old time. But that's a good one.
What do you think it is with this synthwave? Because I was at work today with my mates, and all we do is have synthwave on the TV, you know? Like, what is it about that music now that's making it so popular with these old fuddy-duddies?
I wish I knew. But one thing about synthwave that I've noticed is that new generations are popping onto it as well. Like you're getting 20-year-olds, 18-year-olds that are making synthwave now. There's something there. Again, it's an 80s thing, right? But that Blade Runner style music, that dark wave, this is all wonderful music. Right now, synthwave is my favorite genre. And I grew up as a heavy metal guy before I moved into hard electronica. Synthwave is, how do I put it? Marty Friedman from Megadeth once put it really well. He said that when he left Megadeth, he got tired of playing everything gunmetal gray. He wanted to paint with like pinks and purples and blues and greens and all. Like, that's kind of what synthwave is in my head anyways. It's, you're painting with more colors. I'm always going to love metal. I'm always going to love electronica. But there is something magical about synthwave, isn't there? It's a really good genre. Mm-hmm. I'm really liking it.
But in general, for myself, like, I watch quite a lot of Games Quitters stuff. Are you had a Games Quitters? It's a channel for addicts. A certain percent of people that, like myself, can be really susceptible to gaming addiction.
I'll check it out, but no, I haven't heard of it.
But the thing is with me, like, if I sit and play games for 8 or 10 hours a day, and I still have sometimes the odd weekend now and again where I do that, I just feel so bad after. I feel like I've just wasted so much time, you know. And being a programmer, where you're operating at really high levels of execution of complexity, games just seem really shallow. Even I follow some of the YouTube channels out there, like Grad Brad, and I kind of follow the games, and he's really excited about the game and all this stuff. And I'm looking at him like, this is very exciting to me. You know, I'll sometimes just fast forward the video at like 10 times speed just to see if there's any new things that are happening in the game. But apart from just graphics changing, it's all repetitive to me. All the shooting and killing and shooting and killing and shooting and killing, it's all the same. It's just better graphics. And, you know, it's actually kind of interesting watching some of the, I watched the Halo Infinite one, but they're grappling around. But even that, you get up to the top of the level, it still looks, it's still the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just running around shooting the same old grunts.
Yeah, I've always been a picky gamer, more so as I get older. So a game has to hook me in 30 seconds. I am not kidding you. That's like, if it goes over 60, like for the life of me, I still to this day cannot get into certain games. Like, what's that one game? See, I've already forgotten it already because it's so hard to get into. But yeah, like a game like Skyrim, I know you're not a fan, but I got into Skyrim instantly. Sniper Elite 4. Like I got into that game instantly, but, you know, Halo Infinite, I bought it. It's okay. It's not the best, but there are some games that I just cannot. I try and I try and I try multiple times to install them. I just can't do it. So, yeah, I know what you mean. It's they could look the best that they've ever looked. The sound could be great. The character development could be great. Something has to pull me in, and I don't know what it is. There's nothing quantifiable there for me.
I think mobile games are really toxic, because I was playing this game for one. I played this thing called Clash Royale, and I was very good at it. I mean, but the thing is, you get to a point in the game where you're always fighting people that are 2 or 3 levels above you.
And
it's really, really frustrating, because you know you're better skilled than this person, and they're all designed just to take that money from, just take the money from you. I just hate it. I asked Clash Royale to ban me permanently from that game. You know,
please ban me. Please give me.
Yeah. I know. Well,
who was it that had a problem with that? Hearthstone really fell victim to that. Hearthstone, I was into it for a while, but then I noticed that I would never, no matter what cards I got, I would always play against people that were 10 levels above me, and I get my my ass kicked. Mobile games, they have to be they have to be casual, and they have to not be a trap in and of themselves. Like there's a lot of them are pay to play or pay to win games. I got my wife hooked on Gardenscapes, which is really the only mobile game that I play right now, just because it's a simple puzzle game and I don't have to, they don't shove ads down my throat every 5 seconds and make me buy stuff. I can keep playing it till the end. But yeah, mobile games, that is a toxic area. It went toxic fast. I'm really surprised. Yeah.
Physiologically, though, I don't think games are very good for me, because sometimes I sit and I'll play some of those IO games online and just. But I find that my heart rate goes up. You know, I don't know. Is there any games out there that make your heart rate go down? Let me know what they are, you know?
Oh, when I played Doom Eternal, actually the first Doom, the 2016 one, and Doom Eternal, I remember I hit the stop. I went back to the desktop and I was like, looking at my, like, it's just going like this, eh? Like in my chest. And my face was red. And I'm like, and it wasn't because I was mad. It's just because there's so much happening at once. You know, you can't keep up with it. But those are fun to me. I like games that'll keep me motivated in short bursts. I don't like to spend too much time on games. And the game that takes me the longest to play right now is probably Sniper Elite 4. Just because that, to do one level will take you 2 hours. But that's my cutoff point. I don't really go any farther than that.
So that Doom Eternal, it's classed as cartoon violence, right? But do you ever find, like, when you're basically taking that saw, and you know what happens with that saw, I won't describe it. You find it when just walking around the street and you're looking at someone and imagining doing the same thing to the person there? Like,
Not at all.
For you seeing that often, you know?
No, I'm the type of person when I play a game, I have rage quitted in the past, but I'm the type of guy that'll rage quit and then forget about it 3 minutes later and be walking around. Like it doesn't bother me. I've never believed in the link between video games and violence. I think that's a load of crap. I think it's a cop out. I think it's just another excuse for bad parenting. I mean, if you're if you're letting your 10-year-old or your 11-year-old play Grand Theft Auto 5, something's wrong with you. Like, I'm sorry, that is not the game doing that. There are some people I think that maybe shouldn't play those games. Just like there's certain people that shouldn't listen to certain types of music. I'll give you a good example. I don't know if you've ever heard of the darkwave band Lycia, L-Y-C-I-A. Wonderful music, very atmospheric, very deep. It's new age almost, but like a dark new age. If your head's in a good space, that's beautiful music to listen to. If you're depressed or you're feeling potentially like doing something not so good, not so healthy for yourself, don't listen to that music. So the kind of content that you absorb should be content that speaks to your character. I don't have a problem with violent video games. I never have, because I view them as satirical outlets. And I don't dwell on violence very much. I'm not a violent person. I'm the kind of person who will never back down from a fight, but I'm never the person who will start one. So to me, a violent video game doesn't do anything for me. But I do know that there are people that should not be, they should probably pursue something a little bit more healthy.
So the trouble with me in games is that when I do something, I'm very compulsive about it. That's why, you know, I'm focused on this podcast. When I'm programming, I'm focusing on that. But I tell you what, if I play games, I can sit and play it for 2 days straight if I ever get into it. For me, it's like my kryptonite. So I'm very careful, and that's why I'm so like careful about I'd be worried if, you know, if I'm looking after kids and stuff that playing games, because I know how much it would affect me. And I'll sit and play games for 4, 5, 6 hours, and then only get up when I need to get up, you know, and to get some water, go to the bathroom, and my eyes are sore and stuff. So, I mean, this can't be good for you to know. No. I mean, a person like you who can play games and yet still work and be successful, that's for me is an enigma, because I would either, you know, play games or be unemployed, or not play games and be employed, you know? So it's a certain percentage of people that are really not able to play games, you know?
Yeah. If you're playing games, like playing games to that extent, that's a young person's game. When I was 13 to 16 and I didn't have a job, or I had like a part-time job 8 hours a week, and my mother and my father were paying for everything, and I go to school and come home and do a little bit of homework, and I could spend the rest of my time playing games. You know, when you don't have any responsibilities in life, you can play Final Fantasy VI until the sun comes up twice. Like, I remember there were some times
I was never that bad, man.
Dude, like, I used to play...
This comes up twice, man.
I used to play Secret of Mana, and I would start on a Friday night.
Oh, it's a good game.
And I wouldn't get done until Sunday night. And just, like, straight, like...
What?
Got the pop, got the Pepsi, just keep it, you know. And could I do that nowadays? Not on your life. No way.
It looks like you go to the bath and you feel like you're pregnant. You know, there's so much water in you. Yeah.
But when you're young... And you have that much energy, that much balance, and no responsibilities. That's a fun combination. You can sit there and waste your days all you want. But even there, I tried to temper it with at least going outside and doing other things. You know, there were only specific games where I really spent that amount of time on, and certainly none to that extent today. Not even close.
Something must have changed psychology, because if I can tell you, if I went back to the gaming like I did, I would be like an alcoholic, going back to alcohol. You know.
Yeah. When I got married, I thankfully married a gamer girl. So she was, that was a mystery wrapped in an enigma, but she and I will play Ark. We'd be known to play Ark until the wee hours of the morning, but, you know, only on a Friday night, only on a Saturday night when we don't have anywhere to be the next day.
I don't even know what Ark is.
Ark Survival Evolved. It's the one with the survival game where you can tame dinosaurs and you can build stuff. Oh, it's such a simple premise, but you get going on that and it's just addictive. It's all hell. And, but even there, we try to be careful, right? Like, she's got her appointments in the morning and stuff like that. She's not going to spend too much time gaming, but you know, it's fun once in a while to have a bit of a gaming binge, but
I just can't imagine you as a gamer, because I know how entrepreneurial you are. How can you just turn it off and go back to the entrepreneurial stuff? I just can't turn it off. Like, I have to go teetotal almost, you know?
Yeah.
Or satisfy it with like your music to sort of keep the...
Yeah. For me, games are a break, something I do during a break. I don't game and then take a break. I take a break and game. So that's the difference for me. I'm always doing something else in the background, whether it's my work. I'm a writer by trade. Mm-hmm. So whether I'm doing that or whether I'm doing something else or spending time with my wife, gaming is always the break time for me. And
gaming is definitely not something that refreshes me. I come away from a game feeling stressed, pretty much any game it is. So I can't really relate to that, you know.
What's the last game you played?
I play these IO games, like I think it was called Gats.io. It's basically running around with circles shooting each other as 2D, and it's very, very high skill level. People say it's good for your reaction time, stuff like that.
Well, no wonder you're so hopped up. You're playing these reflex games.
You have to really concentrate on what you're doing.
What's that one where they play on YouTube? The level moves really fast and there's spikes and the little box, and they have to make the box jump over things. And it keeps, and these people are trying to do these runs and they're screaming and throwing their controllers and their headphones at them.
The one I have on my mobile right now, it was called Bullet Echo. But it's one of those games like Clash Royale where you get to a certain point where you're always fighting people a lot stronger than you and they want money. Yeah. And I played the game that I have on there. I had Rivals, Clan and Conquer Rivals. It's another money grabbing thing because you're playing that game, and if you read the comments on Command and Conquer Rivals, the comments are just like continually ridiculing Command and Conquer for making this cash generating machine. Because every time you play the game, you're playing someone three or four levels higher than you. And it's impossible to beat them, you know. Even if you've got the best tactics.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, those. That's why I prefer cooperative games. I occasionally play a multiplayer game like Halo Infinite. Multiplayer is really good. I'm having fun with that, but I prefer cooperative games. So I'd be more inclined to play something like Left 4 Dead, where I can team up with four other players, or Streets of Rage 4, where I can, you know, get a guy in Brazil that wants to have a game. You know, that I have more fun with co-op games. I think that for me, co-op games are just more positive. But once in a while, it's good to have a little bit of competition too. It's good to bust out Call of Duty multiplayer once in a while. But I get much more satisfaction out of teaming up with people and making something of it.
Yeah, I was curious about Streets of Rage 4. So basically, I watched a lot of videos on basically the walkthrough, and then I watched the videos with the never ending rounds, and then I watched it so many times that I have no desire to play it in a sense, because I know what happens. So I guess that's for me. If you're tempted to get a game, you don't want a game, you can just watch their run through and realize, hey, it's no big deal. So
they actually did a really good job with it. I have to say, I expected to be a train wreck. And I don't know, Dotemu did a really good job with that. I'm really impressed with that. I mean, I know it's kind of divisive. It's not many people like the music. Other so yeah, either love or you hate it. I think that's what
Streets of Rage is really good in. In that one. Sorry. This is the new hobby. I'm trying to get into art just to keep my. And this is kind of fun. I'm enjoying this. It's a bit more effort than playing games, but it's creative. You know, like your music's creative. I think that's why I'm satisfying my creative urges, you know.
Everyone should do that. I mean, I think that everyone is artistic to some point. I mean, you might not be able to draw well, you might not be able to compose, but do something to get your creative juices out there. I think everyone has a creative side. I don't think that there's a large population of people that are always thinking with one hemisphere of the brain. I think that people should pursue an artistic outlet of some sort, because it's really healthy. It really is.
Cool. Well, mate, I think that's good for our first interview, but anything you want to leave us with before can people get in touch with you, or just thoughts?
It's not really. I mean, just by all means, come by my channel, youtube.com/maestrodraven, and if you like my stuff, please leave a like, and please do as they say on every YouTube video, smash that like button and smash the subscribe button and all that stuff. That's really all you can do. And just enjoy it. Just have fun with what I'm giving you, because I like doing it.
And Maester Draven has a minimum age requirement of 34 years old.
Yeah, so. You got to be 33 to 49 and male. No, don't listen to any of that. Please, everyone, like 12-year-olds, come to the channel, watch my stuff. You'll enjoy it. So,
okay, cool. Well, I appreciate your time, mate, and we'll keep in touch.
I had a lot of fun. Thanks for inviting me on.
Cheers. And thanks, everyone, for watching. See you guys soon on the Nikos Show. Bye-bye.